Hello, and welcome to this very special bonus episode for the Roundhouse Making Space podcast. Yes, you're thinking correctly, I'm not actually Marcus Davey. My name is Charisse. I'm an investigative reporter for Channel 4 News and Roundhouse alumni.
And I'm Katie. I'm a podcast producer and also a Roundhouse alumni. And we have the very special job of speaking to Marcus Davey. Until the 1st of June 2026, he is and has been the CEO and artistic director of the Roundhouse. And after 27 years leading the organisation, he is stepping down as the boss.
And Marcus has consistently championed young and alternative artists, transforming the Roundhouse into a major creative centre and a safe space for many young people.
He is also the host of this podcast, Making Space, speaking with incredible guests including Daniel Kaluuya, Imogen Heap, Sir Anthony Gormley, Cecilia Knapp, Akram Khan and Jack Rook. They've been exploring the value of creativity and the arts in society. Today, we have the rare opportunity to turn the tables and the interviewer becomes the interviewee.
And going back a little bit, you grew up in Cumbria, Worcestershire, alongside your two brothers, Dan and Lawrence. You put on your first concert at age 14 and you haven't had a year off since then. And it was only 16 years later in 1999, way before I was born, I wasn't even a thought in my mum's mind at that point, you found yourself in an old train turning shed in Camden, at the start of what is now one of the most iconic art spaces in London. And yes, we are biased because we've basically grown up here creatively, but it is so wonderful to welcome you here to the podcast.
Well, thank you. And the tables have been turned on me. I wasn't expecting that, but if anyone was going to turn the tables on me, it's you two. And, you know, you've played a really important part in the Roundhouse life and my life, and I'm thrilled to be here with you.
So, obviously, in Making Space, you ask the guests questions that they don't always get asked. So we're going to try and do the same to you. So get comfortable, because it's going to be lovely, I promise. So, Marcus, we would love for you to take us back to 1999. You've made it through the interviews with Torquil Norman. You've got the job secured. Congratulations. And it's your first day as chief executive of the Roundhouse. Can you paint us a picture of what you're looking at? Because we've basically heard it's a railway, turning shed. What are you actually seeing in front of you?
So on the 3rd of August 1999, I walked up the old stairs, which is kind of these old brick stairs which had been built in the 70s, and it had been raining quite a lot. And I'd been a couple of times already to see an amazing show in the main space called Della Guarda. The building was a wreck. That none of the new stuff that you see was there. The Roundhouse didn't even own a light bulb, and there was nothing. Everything was rented in. Even the power came from a diesel generator because it was a redundant space. And the land next to it, actually, we're sitting in a beautiful building near the Roundhouse. This was all owned by somebody else. And what Torquil hadn't told me was that unless we got ownership of that land, we would not be able to do the rebuild of the Roundhouse.
Really?
So, yeah. So it was kind of like my first day was like, gulp. What I saw was there was a few metal containers which were used for offices right next to the Roundhouse. And it was quite a warm day and it was just before the lunar eclipse. So I can remember it's a very special moment. Those containers I worked in for 4.5 years, okay, and Torquil used to joke, said, yeah, we have heating in those and we have air conditioning. Just so happens that the air conditioning comes on when you open the windows in the winter and the heating comes on when you close the windows in the summer. And there literally was no heating or air conditioning. So in their metal cabins, and it was absolutely boiling. Inside the Roundhouse, the downstairs part in where the Roundhouse studios are now, these were broken down walls and it was infested with rats and, you know, and it looked a bit like something out of the set of a horror movie. Think Blair Witch Project in the woods and, you know, that's what it was a bit like. But in the main space, it was this beautiful building which had been kind of a bit messed up with concrete balcony here. And it was, but it had that kind of rich, grubby, authentic freedom to it. And I just fell in love with it from day one. I had a meeting with Torquil on the first day and then I was left to get to know the team. The team was vast. I mean, it was 4.5 people. And now we're about 200 people, plus casual workers and freelancers and everybody else. It was tiny. And it was this land was a wasteland of dust, basically. But it was a kind of existential living because it was freezing cold, boiling hot. We didn't have any of the money raised when I first started. We had to raise £30 million to rebuild the roundhouse. And that's equivalent to what now, 60 or 70 million. There was a very small board. There was a very small staff. We just had no money. Torquil had bought the building. And in the end, we were lucky enough for the land to be purchased as well, which he did with his trust, which he had set up, called the Norman Trust. And that was nearly all the money from the Norman Trust. So that was about 6 million quid for the building and the land. And then we raised the 30 million on top of that. Mm-hmm. And Torquil and I worked really closely together for 7 years until we reopened the roundhouse on everything from the design to the building of the staff team. And then he stood down as chair 1 year later in 2007. And I suppose we might get into some of that in due course.
Yeah. But, yeah. So you're looking at this desolate building.
Yeah.
And I know you said you had that gulp moment, but like, what else is running through your mind? I mean, a panic screaming or just the serene calm of, you know what? It is what it is.
I was so excited, and I think I'm quite a resilient person and I like a challenge, especially a positive challenge, because problem challenges are always difficult. But this was a problem of a different magnitude. And most people that I knew in the arts world had said, you're bonkers, it's been cursed, it's never going to work, it's never worked in the past, it's never going to work in the future. Why would you do that? Your career's going really well. And I kind of fell in love with the project, the idea of putting young people at the heart of a major public institution, that it was independent and kind of focusing on something that was really important, i.e. young people and the art, of course, but it was young people at the heart of it. And Torquil was an incredible human being. I mean, he had made his money from toy making, Polly Pocket in particular. And
oh,
he wants
stop, really.
Yes,
he loved he, Polly Pocket. Polly Pocket stan. I love Polly Pocket.
It has even more value.
I used to say that the roundhouse was bought with Polly Pocket's pocket money.
Yeah. So we've really invested in the roundhouse in some way.
Yeah, you helped yes. The roundhouse. So he invented, or somebody else invented, he developed and did all the plastic mouldings and made it. And he was really intricate. He was an engineer more than anything else, I think. And so he wanted to support a whole generation of young people to find their future through creativity, art, whatever it was, and to return the main space into a world-class performance space. And I hope that's what we have done. And since then, of course, we built two new buildings, expanded the programme, expanded everything. And he died last year, aged 92, but he was so proud of what we had all done, and he was so proud of his legacy. And, you know, we should all do this, which is to say a little prayer to Torquil every single day because of what he did. He didn't have to do it. He could have kept all that money himself. But he said to me one day, all these people with so much money, they can buy this, they can buy that, but actually at the end of the day, if you leave something that makes the world... He didn't know one of the young people that he was going to benefit. He didn't know any of the audiences, and they didn't know him. But what he did was to do something of huge importance to everybody. So all of us benefited from that vision. And it partly came from his wife, Anne, as well, who said, Torquil, you've got to do something with your passion, which isn't sitting around at home when you retire or sell the business. And his family got involved. His son is still a trustee, Casper Norman, who was there from the very earliest days. His other son, Jesse, has been really involved, and Amy and Lulu and Casey, they've all been involved in different ways. So he not only bought the roundhouse, but he kind of brought his family and network into it as well.
It's a really selfless thing to do, actually.
I mean, he was a kind of relentless, determined, but persistent, extraordinary kind of very tall, 6'7" or 8" or something.
Gave you a run for your money.
Yeah. Well, that's true. But there was something so generous about him. He kind of brought you into his family as well. So I felt like a kind of adopted person in the family because we all did stuff together. And it wasn't easy all the time, I've got to say, but I learned so much. And I think I arrived with a sense of huge success of what I've been doing before, with a kind of sense of arrogance and ego, thinking I can do this. And I think I thought I knew everything. Within 6 months, I realised I knew nothing. And I realised that Torquil was more of my project than the roundhouse. And so I supported him in what he wanted to do. And then after a year or so, he said again, you do all that, I'll do this. And then you do all that and I'll retire. And what a brave and brilliant man. You got it open for the world and then say, well, actually, I feel somebody else needs to do it next. Incredible.
And just kind of staying on when you first joined. You said before that when you started the Roundhouse, I don't think I had any fear whatsoever. Looking back, was that a sense of confidence? Was it naivety? Or were you just pushing through that kind of fear? Or was it the passion of putting young people at the heart that really drove you forward?
Yeah, so I think to answer that question, I'll jump back in my life a bit.
Yeah, please do.
When I was 14, I did put on a concert. But when I was 14, my hair fell out. When I was 14, I was being bullied at school. And I was at the bottom of every class. I was shy. And I found everything really difficult. It was really, really difficult. I was literally at the bottom of remedial classes. And nobody could work it out. Because my brothers both were, you know, brilliant. My one brother up got a scholarship to Oxford. And, you know, it was just felt easy to him, and I struggled, and I suddenly found myself in music and in visual arts, and then a year later in sport. It wasn't until I was 50 that somebody at a party was saying, so how do you do this and how do you do that? And, you know, really kind of being like you two and curious and inquisitive and investigative. And I said, this is how I do things. And they said, well, did you know from a kid that you're dyslexic? And I said, no, I'm not dyslexic. I know people who are dyslexic. No, I can work things out. And they said, but you just said this. And I said, yeah, but everyone's like that. They said, no, they're not. So I went, okay, well, I went to the British Dyslexia Association, had the 3-hour exam, and that was the worst thing I've ever had to do in my life. I felt absolutely awful at the end of it. And they said, you're really dyslexic. And it kind of put a different kind of spin on my childhood, which was I was struggling to understand what people were saying to me, processing information. But it was music and art particularly that gave me a future. So I think that when I came across this project, the Roundhouse, I'd already, in everything I'd done, included young people in everything I did, with young people on the stages when I was putting on shows, when I was director of the Norfolk and Norwich Festival or at Dartington. And that was a main thrust. I was chair of the Hackney Youth Orchestras Trust, which I was really passionate about. But I didn't know why. And over time, I worked out why, that this was a thing right in the heart of me. If it was good enough for me, then maybe there are a lot of young people out there who need that extra kind of bringing together to learn from each other and feel that they're part of a tribe or a sense of belonging to somewhere that was not available to them elsewhere. All young people together doing something. And so for me, coming into the Roundhouse, that was something inside me which I didn't understand until later.
And I guess that's also, you were forging your own way of doing things and your own path. And that's very much what the Roundhouse allows people to try and to do and to forge in their own way that works for them, that is uniquely them as well.
Well, I've got so much energy from that over the years, from other people achieving more than they thought they could. But also there's something about the round, it's a circle. And, you know, it's a circle of trust. It's a circle of being together. And it's an equality. Okay, yes, I'm chief executive and artistic director and all that, but where I get my energy is from talking to all people, and you learn so much. So actually talking to young people have given me some of the best ideas for stuff that we've done. So it was one young person I was talking to years ago who said, I said, what are you doing next? They said, well, I'm just working from cafes and stuff. And I said, well, do you need somewhere to come and work, like a workspace? And then we're sitting in this building which has got Roundhouse Works, which is a workspace, and it's full of young people making their way through life in a different way, not on stage, but in different ways. So that gives me energy. And so that energy has been given to me. It's not something I take and it's not something I give, but it's something that energizes me.
And forging your own path, it also, that can be a risk sometimes because it doesn't always work out. And when you were speaking to Imogen, you said that embracing risk is essential. But for people that maybe struggle with embracing risk, what advice would you give to help them kind of move forward? Like, what do you do when you need to really push through that risk? How do you get yourself over that hump?
Okay, so I try and do everything differently. And I call it having a mango for breakfast, because I don't have a mango for breakfast. And what that means is, if you're struggling with your line manager at work or your people around you, you're stuck in a rut and you need to move forward, it's not them, it's you. And you need to take the responsibility to do everything differently. So I would have a mango for breakfast, walk backwards up the stairs, train your mind to think differently. And then you'll sort of go, oh, that's why. Ask them why, stand in the other person's shoes, and then sort of give yourself permission to have different kind of conversations. And once you start practicing that, you sort of go, oh, I'm free of all that stuff. But I would say that some people take into life, because of the stuff that has happened to them in their childhood, a whole rucksack of horrors. And let's say that they are really heavy, gnarly rocks. You've got to try and work out a way of letting go of those rocks. Nobody ever succeeds. Nobody's walking on water, right? We're all burdened with some stuff that have happened to us in our lives. But the more you can get rid of those and don't land them on other people, because that's another trait that we do in life, is to take our rubbish and give it to other people. But let it go. Let it go. I don't need to take that. That was somebody else's problem. Let it go. Have a mango for breakfast. Walk backwards. Do things differently. Start the day at 7 instead of 9. Finish by going for a run. Have tea instead of coffee. Do everything differently. And I promise you, within a couple of weeks, you will think differently. And it'll set you in the pace for being able to take a risk.
It's that change of perspective.
It's almost like a thinking creative practice, isn't it?
So you both summed it up much better than I just waffled on for ages. And you just look at perspective and practice. Yeah, I could have just said that. Could I do that next time? But have a mango for breakfast.
Yeah, you need to trademark that now.
Yeah.
So again, we'll go back. We're going to be going back and forth here. Let's talk a little bit about where you grew up. How has that influenced you, especially moving to London? Because I know you were in Cumbria and Worcestershire. Very different places to London, or maybe not, similar in some ways.
Well, I was only born in Worcestershire. Mm-hmm. My parents had been out for a walk, and I was born in the flat at home. And my little brothers would have been 2 and 1, and I was born at home before the midwife came round, I believe.
Oh my God,
and
wow.
Then she came round, and then the doctor came round, and that's all happened like that. And then we moved to, I think, Gloucestershire. And that was like little ragamuffins running around free. It was the 1970s and we were in flared trousers and it was just flower power, freedom. It didn't matter that I was at the bottom of every class. I was free and I just loved it. Then we moved to Cumbria and there were darker skies. It was colder. And then suddenly education kind of kicked in and everything was being taken more seriously. And then they realized I couldn't do some things. And then it all became difficult. And I went to a school my parents taught at, and there was a lot of bullying, which I didn't enjoy, of course. And I was actually usually the person being bullied. And that was psychological and physical. And that's when I was coming back around to, you know, I kind of hid in music and the other things that I did. So we moved around the country. And I think it was only when I went to Dartington College of Arts in Devon to do a music degree that I kind of went, I'm in my tribe. This is fantastic. I couldn't believe it. It was absolutely amazing. People were singing and they were making art and protest art. And I got involved in everything. I was in live art, performing as a phantom, and I was doing music for dance. I even ended up in a show which somebody had developed in college called, it was about the Titanic, but it was a very live art dance piece, and I was playing cello in it. But we had to do movement as well. It ended up in The Place in London. We came on tour. It's amazing. But with the Chamber Orchestra, we went to St. John's Square in London and a few other places. Now, what you talked about earlier, which was about making my own path, I made my own path through that. And that was the great freedom of Dartington College of Arts as it was. It's now closed down, which is a tragedy, because it enabled you to find your own path. And if you took your own path and developed it, you could do almost anything. So I did composition and a thing called music and society, but I did music and dance and theatre and visual arts and all these kind of things. You can imagine me with just kind of like, oh, I'm getting up to do this every day.
It sounds like a dream.
It was a dream. And everyone was doing the same kind of thing. But I'll tell you one story, which is a friend of mine called Lee had a motorbike, and he was quite a powerful motorbike. He was as tall as me, red hair, big, thick red hair. And I was on the back of his motorbike. We used to go to a place in Newton Abbot to work with people who were disabled, mainly physically disabled, and really both mentally and physically disabled. But there's one person who, he wasn't verbal at all, but you could sing a song and he could play it on the piano.
Wow.
And so we were doing this every week. And then one day I said, oh, it'd be really good to get a video camera to show him what he looked like doing it. And that might give him a kind of different perspective. And I said, can we borrow a video camera? And I said, we don't have a video camera. You've got to remember this was like 1987, yeah. Margaret Thatcher's Britain, and there was no money. And they said, we don't have any money. I said, well, how much do you need? And they said, oh, well, what do you mean? I said, if we get a video camera, and there's no instruments, really. There's one piano. He said, good instruments. And da, da, da. And they said about £1,000. And like, to a student in those days, it was like beyond imagination. It's like 20 grand. So it was like, you had to go and find that. I said, I'll do it. I'll find it. And I set up a 72-hour concert, mm-hmm. fundraising concert. I started it on 8 o'clock on a Friday evening over a bank holiday weekend. We're just coming up to that bank holiday weekend. So that was in 1988. So it's nearly 40 years ago. And went through until the Monday evening. I was up for all the whole of it. And I played in the first X many hours of it on my cello and did some composition stuff. But it was packed and we made 1,500 quid.
Wow.
Which was in like 10 P's and 2 P's and 20 P's.
Wow. Who counted all of that after?
Yeah, Muggins. And some of that is actually on film somewhere. And Darton College of Arts courses were taken over by Falmouth University and that's all down there in the library somewhere. But I took a great big bag of cash and just said, there you go. Just had that over.
We need that footage.
That's amazing.
We've got to see it.
Yeah, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? I have no idea where it is.
Dig up the archives.
But there were some amazing things. The first 13 hours were Indian music, because I knew a lot of Indian musicians. There were music theatre things. There was, we finished with a band called Roger's Shoe. I remember this because my friend, who I'm still friends with today, had written a song with, a last song with a cello in it. And I played that. And that last minute, as it went to 8 o'clock, and I just got up and said, we've done it. Aww. And it was the most amazing moment, because we're all so tired. But it was just joyful. It was just joyful, the whole thing. Being there at 4 o'clock in the morning when there's a small crowd, but it was absolutely amazing.
Like a delirious joy.
Yeah, and I suppose that's where it all started, changed other people's lives, because it was not about my life. I was so privileged. I was a music student. I was doing what I did. It was absolutely great.
And from that story, you can kind of see the solution-orientated personality trait that you have. Mm. What else did that experience teach you about yourself?
Oh, what a good question. I think that if you go into things with an open heart and you have a vision for something and other people share it, because of course I couldn't do that on my own. It was a whole group of people that kind of came together, all the musicians, all the people who helped me serving tea and, you know, coffee and, you know, all the rest of it. It was a team. It just happened I had the stupid idea and then led it. I think we are capable of doing far much more if we give ourselves permission to do so. But you do need to have an open mind to have an idea. And if somebody says they've got a problem, or if you want to do something and they tell you what the problem is, it's partly our responsibility to try and help. So that was, it gave me that kind of thing when I met Torquil and he said, well, I'm going to do this. And everyone was telling me he's mad. Remember one thing on my interview, he said, oh, we've just been turned down from the Arts Council and the Heritage Lottery Fund for funding, so we don't actually have any money. And he said, do you still want to carry on with the interview? And I went, I think this is the greatest project anyway. And that just seemed like a tiny problem, because this was a big opportunity. And if you think of things in problems, you never think about things as opportunities. So I think that was a kind of clinching moment for me. I did a 72-hour concert. You know,
why 72 hours?
Because I think I wanted to make it a world record-breaking concert.
Was and then, it?
Well, it wasn't monitored by the world record.
You were, yeah. Fair enough.
And there were 98 different groups performing.
Wow.
And there are very strict rules and regs. So we did say in the posters, so I got people to make three different sorts of posters as well, sort of going marathon concert, world record-breaking concert. So all these different people came in. There were local bands that came in and many young people. And I think if you put your heart to something that really, really believe in, as long as you've got the right support, you can do it.
I mean, it sounds like that way of thinking, that opportunities-based thinking, has obviously brought you through your life as well and into the Roundhouse. Has that kind of, looking at how young people approach art, and are there any particular young artists or projects that have completely changed or reframed the way that you look at the Roundhouse or the things that the Roundhouse can do?
Mm. Yeah, when you were asking that question, one sprang to mind very quickly. It was called Puffball. It was a project with the director, Mark Storer. It wasn't my idea. It was brought to me by two colleagues, former colleagues, Josie Bamford and Lucy Atkinson. And it was involving young people, emerging talent, and professional artists who identified as LGBT. And those are the only acronyms that I Q might have arrived by then, but, you know, it didn't have the QI star, all the other letters, with a particular focus on T, trans, because nobody knew what that meant, really, in the established world. So that was transformational, because we also had a young trustee then called Bailey, and they did a presentation to the board about what the impact on society on young people who identified as trans. They gave this presentation to the board. We got training in for the leadership and all the front-facing teams around trans. And we're talking 2013.
Wow.
And this was completely groundbreaking for most of us. It shouldn't have been, because so many people identified for trans for so many years. But we realised soon that no other organisation had done that. It felt to me that there were staff here who could have the authority or the responsibility to have their own ideas. And I love that. I really love that, because then I sort of go, oh, yeah, I can learn from that. We can do that. And that will make this difference to these people. And it really did. It made the difference. And we had then gender neutral toilets, because that was something that was important. We had different spaces, worked out different ways of doing things, had different welcome in the front of house teams. And it really made a difference to people who identified as trans. And we all learned a lot about it, which was great, because then we saw society in a better way. So that was transformational. Again, it's with young people at its heart.
Yeah, I think, as you said, you were working with people who are at the start of their journey and more established artists. And I think you're in such a unique position as well, because you've developed relationships with people all the way through their journey. Are you, I mean, especially doing this podcast and interviewing the people that you have, but are there moments that still, you know, surprise you and you're taken aback? And has there been anything in particular from the podcast that's really made you sit up?
There's something in all of them that all of the guests have talked about, which is the thing inside, which is connected to something outside. And I think Akram talked about it as ancient time or ocean time. Anthony connected Tibetan time. I can't remember the exact words. Cecilia talked about the creativity inside. And Daniel has amazing phrases for all of this as well. And I ask about where creativity comes from and what's it for. And that's the great question. Because if somebody said, yeah, I'm certain I know what that's about, then I'd have thought, no, you don't. And that's the question that we should keep analysing, but hope we never find an answer.
Do you turn that into yourself as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I feel it, that sometimes something switches on. And it's like you have to capture it. You have to capture it. And when I studied composition, it was definitely about writing something down in musical form. And you sort of go, well, where did that come from? Why did that happen? And I've seen that with artists, musicians, and some people call about flow state, when you have no idea what happened to time. And what is time anyway? And Akram talked about being still, finding his stillness on stage. And so did Imogen, actually. And I wonder if we connect with those things in a particular way in particular spaces. So when you see Akram, and he talked about this, being in the round in the main space, and I talked about you're not only seeing him from different angles, but you're seeing other people watching him, watching you watching him. There is nowhere else like that. And of course, the ancients started by doing probably a storytelling about why it was bad to go down to the river because the crocodiles were there, but they did it in a storytelling version so young people would remember it. Then that's where probably theatre came from. But it was under a tree in the round. Now, I wonder if we lost something by having all these end-on theatres and all these end-on concert halls where actually we're supposed to be immersed in it. And that connects you to the ancient time or the ancient beings that we've cut off. Apparently, we only use some of our brains. What's the rest of it there for? Isn't it that? Isn't it the deep connectivity between us that is a good thing? And the more we cut it off, the more we get polarised and the more we are certain about life. I'm more uncertain about life than not about having a life, but what it's there for. When you see people who are right on the edges of society, the incredibly poor, incredibly rich, incredibly polarised around political things that probably they don't really feel, apart from the fact that they've not been listened to. And wonder if that deep connectivity that these incredible artists are talking about is how we really should be connecting with each other. But I wonder. I don't know.
I mean, it's definitely powerful. I feel like kind of when you look at the Roundhouse and the kind of people that come through the doors, everyone is so different with such a different story, but such an openness. And I feel like that is radiated from you. You've kind of brought that culture in, which is really lovely.
Oh, well, thank you. But I think you mentioned the really important thing there, which is story. We all have our own story. And the artists that I interviewed talked about storytelling being the thing. Everything else doesn't matter. It's how you make the story. And you as journalists will bring the story out. And when you've done that, you must feel sometimes, I really got that story.
Yeah, no better feeling.
Yeah, I think you, while it's going, someone will say something and in your mind it goes,
yes, we got it. We got it. We got the soundbite. Yeah. We got the thing we wanted.
And that's what we're all searching for, right? We're all looking for the story. We read books, maybe. We look for stuff. I don't believe that the modern way of communicating has enabled us to understand stories better. I actually wonder if some of the social media is destroying our ability to understand story because it's so short and it's a polarized story. So the more we can have live experiences together, then the more we'll be happier people.
More connected.
Couldn't agree more.
And when do you know when a creative risk is worth taking?
Oh, blimey. So I have made some real mistakes in my life.
tell us. Please share. You're only a human. Well, it's bound to happen.
I think when you've known an artist for a long time, then you have a trust relationship with them and you know they're going to put something special into it. But you can go part of the way down the process and sort of go, actually, that's not going to work. And Imogen talks about this in the podcast, which is when I first contacted her and said, Imogen, you haven't performed for a long time. Would you do something for my last festival for the 20th anniversary of the Roundhouse? And she said, well, maybe I'll just do a 5 or 10 minute improvisation as part of somebody else's show. And I went, well, how would that work? So maybe I can make it like 20 minutes and then you're kind of like, maybe I could work with a dancer. And then it's kind of like, well, could you, I think people would like to hear some of your songs because they haven't heard them for 7 years live. And then that conversation went over like 5 months or something. And then she phoned up and said, yeah, I'll do it. I'll do a full show.
Wow.
And the first show in 7 years. And I completely trust her as a creative artist. That's amazing. But there have been times, I think earlier in my career here where I've trusted something without giving it the rigor that it needs, which is like that. You have an ongoing conversation. Well, how's that going to work? Why is that going to work? Who's that going to be with? And how do you do this? And should we involve these people in this way? So you're a creative producer. I've learned to be a better creative producer. Fortunately for me, I've worked with amazing creative producers who really have nurtured artists, whether that's the team working with Daniel Kaluuya now or when we've worked with some of the big-named artists that we work with, the Wayne McGregors, the Acton Khans and Penny Wallcox and, you know, the Royal Shakespeare Company or whoever it is. And you have to have that creative nurturing to bring out that deep story. And if you haven't got the deep story, you've got nothing. And I think that's what I thought, is that those people are going to work with those people because they're big names, but they haven't got a story to tell. So you go with the story first, and then everything else falls into place.
That's a really key learning. And I guess for a lot of kind of young people, you've mentioned about social media and actually is this kind of interrupting the storytelling process. Is there any other barriers facing young artists today that you worry about?
Yeah, I mean, housing is almost impossible. You need a roof over your head before you do anything. You need food, and that's more expensive, and job opportunities are less. And creative arts or expressive arts in schools have been reduced and reduced and reduced over 15 years. It's a national scandal. We all know that. But the government are now trying to do something about that. But it's going to take a long time. You know, many schools, 40% of schools don't have music or a drama teacher or anything, you know. But surely those are the fundamental building blocks of who we are as humans, to be express ourselves, that deep in connecting to that deep thing inside. All subjects are creatives. You know, working out math problems. But those are working out problems. But to take a blank piece of paper and make a poem on it is extraordinary. And you can all go, how did that happen? But I hear mathematicians talking about the beauty in a formula that they've created. But there's something about the arts, I think. Yes, sports are great and physical health, teamwork, brilliant. There's always going to be a loser, though, because you're in a team. that's good. You learn resilience. That's fine. But there's something about art, which is about real teamwork, because you're working together towards a common goal. I'm not doing down sport because I love sport. Sport's given me a lot as well. But there's something in the arts which should be part of all of our lives, whether you're going to be an artist or a creative, work in the creative industries or not. So that has been pushed aside by government policy, lack of opportunity, and then even some government ministers saying these aren't really serious jobs. And that means parents, especially parents from poorer backgrounds or lower socioeconomic backgrounds, think we want the best for our kids. Of course they want the best for our kids, so we're going to make sure they do sciences. But actually, if you're an artist and you really have to be an artist, you can't let that die because you will die with it. And that is what I think is a massive barrier. There's so many barriers now, and then there's lack of money. And so there's funding cuts as well, and there are lack of places like the Roundhouse which will open its doors, nurture, develop, and encourage well into the future. So I think there are many, many challenges.
And with that current climate, you know, we've spoken a bit about risk and the importance of taking risks and forging your own path, especially as a creative. Do you think that the kind of art sector is not rewarding risk-taking creatives as much anymore? Kind of when we look at the climate, I guess that might be a bit more difficult.
Yeah, I think that it's probably true. There are less donors, there are less, you know, funders, there's less funding. But even if you do it in a small way, it's pretty good. You know, making a podcast, you've got a load of risks within that. You might have a guest who then says some appalling things, but they will only agree to it going out if you include those things. So you're taking some risks. But it's the risk to be creative, the risk to express yourself, to share your soul or whatever you want to say,
to
your
dare.
Heart. To dare to do it. And people say, oh, you're so brave doing that. And I was talking about this with Imogen again the other day, which was you have to be pretty brave to go on the front line as a soldier or a firefighter, go into a fire. But there is something about exposing who you are to a large number of people every single day, because those songs or those pieces of theatre that you've written or those podcasts that you've developed, they're part of you. And you're sharing them with somebody else. And, you know, I think that's true of people like me in my role, that you're trying to develop something in a polarized society, which is much harder, for the benefit of the whole of society. And you have to take those risks. And unless you learn the risks early on, and music is a great way, or theatre, writing, poetry, because you are sharing little bits amongst a small number of groups, and you'll learn, oh, yeah, I could do that. And, you know, Jack Rook talked about how he was shy and wrote some stuff in a small group of the Poetry Collective at the Roundhouse, and he got pushed back, but then doing comedy tours around the country, he was then resilient. He was more resilient because everyone, you know, booing, whatever, you know, getting the banter from the audience. Learning how to be resilient is a really important thing. So sharing your depth of who you are early on is a great way to do that.
And I think, I mean, going back to what you were saying about what you learn from the arts, you learn to be really disciplined, because it's not easy to keep going back and try again and make it better or tweak it in some way. And you're very rigorous because you have to keep going, whether it's a calling or you're doing it for young people or someone else and to improve someone's life. You learn so much from the arts just in those practices, but in, you know, how you express yourself, how you're vulnerable and channeling that in a way.
I'll give you an example of something like that, because I remember there was, when in my early days, there were some business people who kind of got involved and they said, yeah, but they're not very rigorous. And, you know, and I said, OK, in 2 years' time, I can guarantee you what will be on that stage at 8 o'clock in the evening, and it'll be well prepared and well developed. How are you doing with High Speed 2? You know, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And they kind of look so shocked, because you need a rigorous process. You know, what goes into putting on a live event across the whole of the country or on TV or anywhere else? And these are all arts. It's rigor and it's really stressful and it's really tight, but nobody lets you down.
It's the community. That's what I think makes this place so special and holds so many special memories for me, is like coming from a not a creative background and being able to come here and find a community, some of my best friends. That's been like the most special thing, and has helped me move through creative projects and careers. And I think that's like the best thing about the Roundhouse, is that community, that push together, I think is so special.
I think you described it much better than I did, which I was trying to find your tribe.
Yeah.
The community there are lots of communities here, whether it's the community of the volunteers or the community of the young creatives and the podcasters or the musicians or across the intersection of all of those things. But I can tell you a bit of a story about community which touched my heart so strongly. The London riots were happening, and the night that they kicked off, we had the opening of that huge installation that we commissioned from Ron Arad called Curtain Call. We had 900 guests, and then they started to leave, and then we had 150 down in the cafe for dinner afterwards to say thank you to all the donors and the big supporters and the artists and so on. And then we had a call from the police saying riots kicked off. We'd noticed it on the news as well, and we were thinking, well, actually, we should probably get home. And they said, no, get everyone into the main space, lock the doors, go now, turn all of the lights off because it's coming Dusty Chalk Farm. And I went up and stood in the bar in the shadow so nobody could see me. And literally, they were smashing up all the windows and loads of stuff being stolen out of the shops and smashing everything. And then one of my colleagues came and said, there's a group of people standing outside the front of the roundhouse. I said, quickly, let's get them in. And they went out and talked to them. They wouldn't come in. And I said, what's going on? They said, they're parents. I said, what do you mean? They're parents of young people taking part in the studios, and they don't want to let anybody touch the roundhouse.
Oh, wow. That's really powerful.
That's so powerful.
And what better expression of community can you get? That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, they were saying not the roundhouse, so the roundhouse was not touched. Everything else was smashed up. The roundhouse was not touched.
To support and protect.
Support and protect.
I mean, I know I can see that's taking you back, but can you remember how you felt in that moment when the parents said that to you?
Well, it was one to one of my colleagues, actually, but yeah. My breath was taken away because would I have done that? You know, I sort of go, this must mean more to them than I've realised. But I've heard other stories since, like when we're doing Centre 59, Daniel Kaluuya project we do with Daniel Kaluuya, actually upstairs in this building, it's the end of a week of a theatre week over the summer, and they were kind of 15 to 17-year-olds, I think. And I was sitting next to one of the parents. They had no idea who I am. I go into those completely incognito so I can ask questions. I said, oh, have you got a young person in here? And they said, oh, yeah, that's my son over there. And I said, oh, how old is he? And he said, 15, but, you know, he's having a tough time. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, this project actually saved his life. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, he was so depressed. He was so down, he stopped eating and we didn't know what to do, but he loved Daniel Kaluuya's film Get Out. And when we saw that this project was on, we signed him up and he got randomly selected because it was totally oversubscribed. And I took him in the first day and he was shaking, nervous, he was withdrawn and he didn't. And at the end of the first day, I picked him up and he was talking like he hadn't talked for a while. And by the end of the week, he was coming an hour early and coming back with friends to the house, which he hadn't done for a year. And he was saying, I'm going to do these for my GCSEs. But I've heard that so many times that it's become quite normal, which is really weird, but it's not normal. It's not normal. This stuff matters. It's not just matters because it's at the roundhouse. It matters wherever it is. It matters because there's something really important in all of us. And if we close it off, then we will suffer from it. And that's another sense of community, because those young people will remain friends. And what are friends? They're network. And what a network? They're people who have your back when you need it.
Also, having a community makes it easier to take risks. I think having people around you with the same mindset, driving towards a similar goal, it makes it easier to feel like, well, I can definitely do this because my friends are doing it. And I think that's something so special that is provided here.
Confidence, resilience, and then you can take risks. You're right. It's a group of people going towards a place together. Like I said, the circle of trust. You get a circle of trust and then you build that together. Now, it sounds quite airy-fairy, but I've seen it and it's real and people are doing their thing and we're not interfering. That friendship group, that's friendship group. Great. But if you haven't got a degree, you don't have a network group. And if you come here and other places, you get a network group, you get a friendship group, and they will hold you as you will hold them.
And it's also just having role models, they're your peers. Role models don't always have to be up. It can also be sort of horizontal.
Often better.
Exactly, because they can do it and you can do it too. And you shared that really lovely story of, you know, it's a behind the scenes moment. It's something that just happened between you and that parent. And that's so special to hold. Are there any other moments or a particular thing that, you know, it's a behind the scenes thing that audiences will never see, you know, sometimes your staff will never see, that you're really proud of and hold?
This story is quite difficult to tell because I get a bit emotional about it, but I'll try and tell it. Okay, so it had been a long journey to raise the money, to get the planning permission, get the licensing. We're coming to the 1st of June 2006, so we're coming up to the 20th anniversary exactly of that date. And we hadn't got any of the licenses, the practical completion, all the other licenses that we needed. The builders hadn't finished. We had 900 guests coming for the opening night of Fuerza Bruta in the main space to say thank you for them, thank you to them. We'd actually just opened the studio theatre with a young people show with a fairly young actor at the time called David Harewood and a group of young people. I mean, he was fairly well known. During the course of the day, we had to get all the contractors out. On the yard here, on the terrace, the builders were putting the blocks down on the terrace. We're having a reception out there a couple of hours later. So I was helping putting blocks down. And we had staff going around cleaning. We had everyone was just doing loads and loads and loads. And I was outside on the terrace. And my brother Lawrence phoned me and said, Leo's fine. That's my nephew. I said, what are you talking about? He said, remember, he's going in for the operation today. It's just a little operation, but he had bled very badly. And I said, oh, my God. And it suddenly just turned the whole thing context was like, it really doesn't matter. And we'll try our effort. But this is a human life, a real life. And this is to say thank you to 900 people. That's really important. But if we had to postpone it three nights or something like that, everyone would understand. And at that moment, the block layer put the last block in. Somebody came to me and said, we've got practical completion, we've got all the licenses, we can open. I said, but I thought we had some problem with the cabling. I said, we'll sort that. Anyway, we've got a problem downstairs though. And he gave me a key and he said, I need your help with something. And he took me downstairs to the front door and he said, can you reach up to that key, that door? You can guess what's coming. And he said, why are you asking me to do this? And he said, you're tall. And I turned it around and I swung the door open and I heard this huge applause and all the staff came around the corner with glasses of champagne and a huge cake, roundhouse cake, came around the corner and they just said, you've just reopened the roundhouse.
Aww.
I suppose that was a really special moment because it wasn't a grand thing. It was just a group of us who had all worked together towards a common goal. And we did it in our way, quietly. And they surprised me, which was really nice. And then we opened that night and, you know, the great stars, Ewan McGregor and Helen Mirren and loads of others came, opened the building, and 13 weeks of sold-out shows came. And the rest is history. About 6 weeks later, no, 5 weeks later, on the 5th of July, weirdly happened to be my birthday, we opened the Roundhouse Studios with the arts minister came, a young David Lammy, who kind of came and opened the Roundhouse Studios. And that summer it was packed. And yeah, it was a long journey, but those are very special moments, which the world didn't see, but I'm sharing now.
Thank you for sharing
Beautiful.
That as well. You have such great perspective, Marcus. And I think, you know, sitting here, obviously 20 years later, I can feel your heart still like glowing, remembering that feeling. What else keeps you optimistic about creativity and this space and the arts in general?
This isn't being trite, but you and Charisse, that's what keeps me optimistic.
Marcus.
Do you know why? Because I've seen you both come through this and be part of the Roundhouse, and I've seen many, many others. And I'll give you an example of young trustees. So I interview the young trustees. I brought young trustees onto the board 20 years ago. They serve a year. And each year we interview 10 to 15, something like that, and take two or three. And at the end of those days, it's been a long day, I say the future of humanity is fine because of the sense of hope that they want to do something. And even some of them who are from the most challenging backgrounds feel that they want to give something to a place that gives hope. And it's a kind of lighthouse or a beacon of saying, everything we do here is about young people. Whether that's the gigs program, which is a great moment of joy, but it also drives in income, if it's about the bars. But our artistic program, our 360 Festival, which includes young people in everything it does. The buildings are about young people, and they're open and accessible to young people. It's cheap. It's £2 a session, or, you know, 25 quid for a year, but there are bursaries and scholarships available, you know, as well. And we're targeting those young people that have very little opportunity to come. And when you see the output of the, what our input is, something has changed. The only challenge is we're just here. And wouldn't it be great if there was... There are lots of projects on a smaller scale happening in lots of places. And a lot of the big institutions do a lot of work in schools. It's really, really important. But can you imagine if everyone had that opportunity? If every young person had that opportunity? So I always think there's an opportunity there. So let's try and make that happen. So whatever I do in the future, I'm hoping that will help with that kind of opportunity. The world is really difficult. And I know it's really difficult for young people. I know it's really difficult for lots of people. What did people turn to in lockdown? They turned to going to the park, watching shows on the TV, watching the National Theatre live, listening to podcasts. All of it was art. All of it was creative. All of it was imaginative. People took up colouring in books. Wasn't that amazing? That a lot of people talked about it as well. It was everywhere. It wasn't just us, North London, tofu-eating, quinoa-swilling, Guardian-reading lovies. It was actually talked about widely. Yeah. And I often talk about, if you took the art out of the high street or the creativity out of the high street, the art creativity, okay, first of all the cars are designed, so they're gone. All the adverts are gone. Clothes will just be in sacks again. And then all that lovely packaging on, you know, everything, that'd be gone. But people walking down the street listening to music, all that would be gone. And people on there scrolling or watching a little bit of TV, that would be gone. So what's left? What is left? AI. So... what we have to do, the next thing we have to do, is to invent a way to use AI for the benefit of humanity in all its ways. And we can do that creatively. If we let the corporations take it on and just that is the way, you're just going to be given this and the lowest possible, cheapest form of sliced white bread with no nutrition in it. What we've got to do is to make sure the sourdoughs are going to be as cheap and available to everybody as the white sliced bread. And somehow we have to do that. That gives me hope, because there is hope.
There
and
is.
The hope thing is easy to destroy in one way, but it's impossible to destroy completely, is my feeling. So I do look back at you both and think you're kind enough to come and do this today. I mean, you know, draw the short straw. But the
not true.
We wouldn't miss it.
Absolutely, we wouldn't miss it.
I see it on stage at the Roundhouse. I see it amongst the young people. And it's a sense of togetherness, connectivity, and doing the thing that's driving them inside. But I reckon it's inside everybody.
Yeah, it's just if you're in the right space to pull it out.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree more. Are you ready for your quick fire?
Okay, this is the one I've been dreading.
Okay, ready?
Yeah.
What was your first job?
My first job was working on the local farm haymaking, which is picking up hay bales and throwing them on the back of a truck. Bit of lambing. And then I suppose my first proper job was working in a cafe, which I absolutely loved, making salads and serving. I'm really good at serving.
Oh, okay.
We've got to try one of your salads sometime.
Yeah. That was a long time ago, though.
And what was the last time you laughed until you cried?
I think it was my son the other day. So when the Guardian said it was an enlightened series, and he said it's enlightened because the light comes through the window and shines off the top of your head. And I thought that was so funny.
It does look really shiny, actually. Like,
and I polished it this morning.
Favourite music artist of all time? Difficult question.
That's almost impossible, because there is certain music that I love, like Bach and Mahler and Mozart and Handel and loads of people like that. I think if you were saying who are my few that I'd take to my desert island disc, who are a singer-songwriter, then it would probably be Nina Simone.
Gorgeous choice.
Gorgeous. Favourite spoken word artist of all time?
That's naughty because I'll get it in the neck from so many. But I think Kay Tempest, definitely, who I was joyed to meet recently, Harry Baker, Maureen Onwenali, Cecilia Knapp.
Marcus, this is a long list.
Yeah, this is a very, it's not really a favourite, yeah. It's more of a favourite collection.
I could go on for about 20 minutes on that one.
Okay, a show at the Roundhouse that changed your life forever.
There have been so many, and it would be a show. I think it might be the show that we were talking about earlier, the one with Mark Storer, the one before the Puffball, he did another, which the young people, it was all young people, and they named this. I was really anti this name. It's called The Fat Girl Gets a Haircut and Other Stories, but it was so beautiful. Yes, I've seen Jay-Z and Lady Gaga and all those kind of people who are amazing, but there was something raw and, like Sir Columbia, they were so raw and on the edge, but they were expressing something not because they necessarily wanted to, but because they needed to.
If you were Prime Minister for the day, what would you do for the arts and young people?
If I was Prime Minister for the day, I think most of the people would run out of the country quite quickly. But if I was Prime Minister for the day, I would make the curriculum very different in the country. I would say that, yes, English, maths, some of the sciences, humanities, really important. But I think there needs to be much more adventure, creativity, risk-taking in the curriculum. And art should be at the centre of an imagination, to imagine a future that includes AI, because we're still building an education system for the 19th century. So I'd put that into place, and I would double the pay of all the salaries of teachers and all the support staff. Mm. I would make schools the heart of communities and art centres the other hearts of communities by quadrupling their funding, but to make sure that there was a Roundhouse in every city and town in the country.
Amen. We love to hear that.
Clicks all around. What does the Roundhouse mean to you? Oh, that's quite a big question. What does the Roundhouse mean to you?
I was really hoping you weren't going to ask me that question. Because I'm a bit emotional coming to the end, because I've got 5 days left in the office, and this is a big moment, and to ask me a question like that, it's quite difficult, because apart from my family, it's everything.
And it shows, because it's you. It's like your heart. Is this place?
I'm lucky. I've got an amazing group of people I work with on a day-to-day basis, the directors. I've got a board and a chair, Simon Turner, who is one of the best people I've ever met. And together we have made something that I think is worthy of what it stands for. But for me, it means the world, because it says to the world, this isn't just about Velvet Curtain doing something brilliant. That's wonderful. But this has got something that will last forever.
And Marcus, let me just say, you also are everything to the Roundhouse. We wouldn't be here without you as well. So I want you to take that to heart as well.
Yeah, let it sit. Like, from everything you've told us today, I haven't learned that much about you until this conversation, kind of learning about your roots. It is so beautiful to see kind of how your personality and your drive and you forging your own path from all those years ago, from creating your own festival, all of that heart is within the Roundhouse, and that's so special. You should really kind of take pride in that.
I think it's going to take a while for me to understand what's happened here for me, because I look back on that teenager who was people called a failure all the time, and I still hold some of that inside me, that it's, yeah, I feel that something really amazing has happened here, but it wasn't me. It was a whole group of us, and I'm just very lucky, hugely privileged to be able to be part of it. And it is amazing. It is amazing. Everything I see, my colleagues every day running up the stairs in the metal office building, even the worst times, which there of course are, when people are polarised and difficult times, the outside world is impacting on the inside world, and you think, I'm still in the privileged position of being part of this organisation. It really is a privilege, because you walk lighter because of it. Because you feel the confidence given to you, or self-esteem, because, you know, anywhere I go in the world, I say, I work at the where? You work at the Roundhouse. Okay, there might be people from the musical arts world, you know. But, or somebody says, I once got a taxi, and the person said, so what do you do? And I said, oh, I work at the Roundhouse. They went, I used to go to gigs there in, you know, years ago. But my grandkids go there all the time. And they say how important it means to them. And you just think, it means something to all people. And if it doesn't, then it's nothing. And I hope that's the thing that will carry on 30, 40, 50, 70 years from now. It's for all people, not just for the privileged few.
And I know this is probably, it might be even slightly bigger question, but what's next on your agenda? Like, what's your next risk? You've shown that through your life. You're continuously taking risks and forging your own path. What's the next path?
Yes, adventure. And my successor has got a great team to work with. And I've had the privilege of working with people like Michaela Green and Michael Dixon for over a decade, and some other people around the house. And Jenny Molliker, who is coming from English National Opera, starts on the 1st of June. I've known her for 10 years. She's great. She had young people in her heart. That's her background. She was a drama teacher early on, so that's really good. So I feel confident the future of the Roundhouse. And that's really important to me. For me, it's about a few months out and then see what happens next. But I don't want to run another big arts organisation because I want this place to be the special place in my heart. And I've got to an age where actually, I think it'd be wrong. I think the Roundhouse needs young energy. And I feel if I still got that young energy, even though I'm not young. But I started here when I was 32. I got the job when I was 31. And so that's a long time. So adventure, risk-taking, thinking differently, reading some different books, and walking in the trees.
And eating the mango for breakfast.
So much mango.
I will have so much mango. I'm going to buy shares in a mango farm.
Thank you, Marcus, for making space with us. How did it feel being on that side of the microphone? Or the table, rather?
You were very, as you always are, you ask great questions, both of you, and you're very loving and kind, but you have a very good way of getting things out of people that they don't expect that they're going to give. You remind me of one of the greatest journalists I've ever met, was Sue McGregor, who used to be on the Today programme. I met her a few times, and prime ministers would come in front of her, not really kind of prepping properly, and she'd be gentle with them. And suddenly they were saying everything because they were nice. She was nice to them. And then they would catch themselves to go, bloody hell, I'm not supposed to say that. And you have a sense about that. And it's a great, great attribute that you have, both of you. So it's been a privilege for me to talk with you, but I found it quite emotional and stressful.
Oh, bless you.
It's okay. You've done amazingly. And thank you for being so generous with your time and your stories and your heart as well.
Well, yeah, the time has flown.
Good.
You can listen to all other episodes from Making Space wherever you get your podcasts. A huge thank you to you, Marcus.
Thank you so much, Marcus.
Thank you both very much indeed. Let's make space.